Cupid is coming. Cupid is coming.
Yeah, I thought it was St. Valentine.
Yeah, well, I think it's Cupid and...
Because poor old St. Valentine. Didn't St. Valentine get demoted?
I don't
he's
remember.
He's not an important...
I think he's not a saint
He's not
anymore.
An important saint Maybe anymore. Not. But he sure, is important a few days from now,
but
so...
you're going awry here.
I am?
Well, good morning, Dinah's
Oh, yeah, we
and
forgot
lovers.
About that. Well, Dinah's and Lovers, there you go. Lovers.
You're listening to
Lovers
On the Menu.
All Lovers and Travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Will you be my Valentine, my dear?
Oh, I have been for quite a long time.
Yeah, you got a few days to change your mind. And listeners, you have a few days to take advantage of suggestions in today's program. So better listen up carefully, folks.
Yeah, first stop, let's get to the heart of this whole holiday. Did you get that, a pun on heart?
Oh, yeah. Very good, very good.
Chocolate. Here we can find all about chocolate from our friend at Mon Ami Chocolate.
Whose name is Ami, or Amy, or something
Amy.
Like that. Okay, Amy, take it away.
'Tis the season for chocolate lovers, as lovers in general, and so we're going to be talking to somebody who knows about all of them because her business is called Mon Ami Chocolat. Amy Rosenfeld, I've known you for a long time now, but you always have something new and interesting to say about high-end chocolates. I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to say today because you've just gotten back from the West Coast of Winter Fancy Food Show and the Good Food Awards, and you've made all kinds of new orders for your shop. I think I ought to preface this by saying it's not just an ordinary shop. You've actually won awards for your retail operation, haven't you?
Yes, it's been a couple years, but we have won an award from one of the trade magazines. That's correct.
Okay, so your shop's called My Love Chocolate?
It's a play on my name, and yes, it sort of means my beloved chocolate, or if I spelled it properly, which of course I don't,
right.
It would mean my friend chocolate.
Yes.
So it's all about the love of chocolate.
Yes, which you do love, don't you?
I absolutely do. I've already had some today.
We've been interviewing a lot of people we interviewed somebody who wrote a book called Raising the Bar,
okay.
And which is about chocolate and what to expect from fine chocolates. It just keeps getting better and better, huh?
Absolutely. I think, first of all, the United States has really stepped up the last 10 years or so in terms of the quality, the ingredients that go into our chocolate. We're much, actually, our standards are higher than European standards at this point, but no one really ever thinks that way. But the whole bean-to-bar single origin that's been happening over the last couple, 3 to 5 years, has been really great and interesting to see because a lot of the small producers are getting the beans from the same location, whether it's Madagascar or Dominican Republic. And then it's just really interesting to see how they create them a little bit differently and using minimal ingredients, of course.
Well, some of the people who are chocolatiers are really fascinating people because they changed careers, picked up making chocolate for whatever, whimsy or whatever, because they just love it.
Well, I think it really takes a passionate person, and yes, there's quite a few in the industry.
Characters.
And that's in the small batch industry, especially like Sean Askenazi, you're probably referring to, or many others that have switched gears. Amano. Same thing. He was a computer tech, and he's passionate about chocolate, but so many of them have taken the time to really learn chocolate and the industry to create the end result, a beautiful chocolate.
Now, I guess, Amy, we can sort of assume that we know the reason why chocolate is particularly beloved of people on the 14th of February. But is there a reason other than the fact that it turns out people love chocolate and therefore sharing it with someone you love is appropriate on the 14th of February, or is it some chemical result, or is it something else that really made chocolate such a treat?
I think it's everything at this point in our world. I think it did start with the chemical makeup of chocolate years ago and what it makes us feel good. And, of course, it also is a little bit good for us, certain kinds, of course. So I think it's a combination of everything, and it is fun
and
to
this
share.
And this is a really busy time for you and chocolatiers like you, I guess, right?
Absolutely.
Now, let's get back to the Fancy Food Show and the Good Food Awards. You've got a doubleheader there, and you're going to report on some of the trends that you saw, and you were very pleased, weren't you?
I was pleased. I was especially pleased with the Good Food Awards, and many of the chocolatiers, we already work with them, such as Patrick or Amano. So it's always nice to be able to see them, because some of them are not able to go to as many trade shows because they're so small. So that part was nice, as well as the confections, which most of those included chocolate. And I think the biggest craze is just continuing, just the sea salt caramel.
Oh, yeah.
And it is getting a little bit more on the mass side, but then again, there are still some very, very small batch purveyors that are just doing them, and each one is so unusual or so different that it's great to be able to have a selection of them in our shop. So we're not about just one purveyor-producer. We like to offer selection because there's different texture, or some are sweetened with agave, so it creates a whole different finished product. And one of the artisans that we picked up, Fev Artisan Chocolatier out of San Francisco area, they won for a pistachio rosemary caramel.
Oh, so wow.
A lot of interesting flavors.
And who was that?
Fev. So it hopefully will be in Mon Ami Chocolat by Wednesday of this week.
How do you spell that?
It was last Friday, but hopefully by this Wednesday, and we'll have some beautiful gift boxes as well from Chocolatier.
How do you spell it?
F-E-V-E.
I don't know it at all. And they're from West Coast?
They are from the Bay Area, yeah. That is always a great show for me, therefore going to the Fancy Food Show now. You do see smaller producers compared to the New York Fancy Food Show, I find. I think at this point, the West Coast, especially the Bay Area. Okay, so I was saying that I think the West Coast, there's so many wonderful small batch chocolatiers or bean to bar people at this point. And I think a lot of it has to do with that's where chocolate really got started in this country, because of maybe Guittard Chocolate and Ghirardelli. Ghirardelli being
right.
More retail oriented, Guittard being much more industrial. They got their starts back in the 1800s.
So I think that the trend is going to be to continue to kind of flavor up the chocolate.
I think there's two trends. One is the bean to bar, the small batch artisans such as Askenosi, which I think are a little bigger at this point, Amano, Patrick, Ritual out of Colorado, which is beautiful chocolate, Dandelion, which I was fortunate to see their facility in the Mission in San Francisco.
I just got a press release about Dandelion chocolate.
Wonderful chocolate.
It's a funny name, isn't it?
Wait till you see their packaging.
Oh, dandelions, I bet.
No, it's actually beautiful. It's I think, from Tibet or India, the paper.
Oh, okay.
Gorgeous, though. And the chocolate's better. So I think you have that side of it, the single origin bean to bar, where they're using minimal ingredients, typically not using soy as the emulsifier, no vanilla as well, because they just really want you to taste and appreciate true chocolate. And then you have the confection sides, where the Floricel, the caramels, the infusions, they're wonderful. They're great. So you have, I think, both sides of it there. And the pure ingredients, such as there's a new company called Arrowhead Chocolate out of Oregon, and I'm hoping to get their products up after Valentine's Day because everyone's too crazy now. But I've tasted huckleberry in the past combined in chocolate, and it was so sweet and not very palatable for myself, but this, they're using pure huckleberry, so it's a beautiful truffle. So it's really neat to see people like that doing and creating from pure ingredients.
Well, with so much to choose from, you must have criteria as to what you're going to pick up.
Yes, and at this level we do. I do taste, especially the bean to bar. That's important to me, as well as where it's being sold, to be honest with you. So we do have to kind of sit down after a trade show. That's why I can't always just order right there.
Uh-huh.
And I need to think things through. If it's going to go mass market right away, then I don't necessarily always want to pick it up, because we're looking much more for smaller batch chocolate.
Do you have a lot of repeat customers in your shop, or do you, is it just seasonal, or do you have people who are regularly in there buying chocolate, because that's what they do?
We have customers that come every couple days, once a week, Saturday morning is typical, or we have seasonal shoppers, whether they're from West Virginia or Ohio, and we know they're only coming two or three times a year. So it really varies, but I think this trip is such a great location for all food type products.
Now, what is your website?
MonAmiChocolat.com.
MonAmiChocolat, which is
you
the first
got it.
Balance. And can people order from your website?
They can email. I do not have a shopping cart. I think that's a whole other position for somebody, and we're not there yet.
Uh-huh.
And we get too many new products in each week that we much rather either have emails come in, and then we will be happy to call a customer back. so that we can figure out what's best for them based on what's in the shop at the time.
Now, do you ever get the idea you'd really like to make your own chocolate?
We make a few select items. We're known for our drinking hot chocolate.
Right.
And we do package that to go. If you're lucky to get the silver bag, because it's not always in stock, because we have a finicky machine that we have to work with. And then we do make some truffles currently for Wiggle Whiskey, and sometimes there's overrun of those. But at this point, we really love collecting the specialty chocolatiers, mostly from the U.S. at this point, or around the world. So I call myself a collector.
I think, though, you'd have really wild ideas about things you'd like to see made.
There's a couple that I've thought about recently, just because we started making the Wiggle Whiskey truffles. It'd be very simple for me to make a wonderful blue cheese truffle.
Oh, wow.
We do sell another person's, and I would still sell theirs, which is Lily Bell out of Oregon, but a different style, or a different type, I should say. So there are some combinations like that that, yes, I would like to, but maybe in the end of 2013.
Well, Amy, there are only just a few days between now and the famous February 14th. Those of you who have been putting it off and putting it off and putting it off, what you're going to give the one you love, we need your email address right here in this interview so that people don't even have to go to the website to look it up.
Okay, it's info@monamichocolat.com.
So now you've got no excuse, listeners. You sweets for the sweet, you can get from Amy. Thank you so much, Amy, for joining us today and sharing your thoughts on what's happening in this industry that seems to have renewed energy every time we look at it.
Thank you for inviting me to come and talk to you.
Thanks, Amy.
And we'll be back with more Valentine recommendations right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Thanks for standing by. For doing that, you'll be rewarded with some recommendations on how to find that perfect spot for your Valentine's dinner,
or even lunch, maybe, or even breakfast.
I guess. And actually, this is my new best bud that we're going to be talking to, the guy who produced this book. The book's called Where Chefs Eat,
and the guy is Joe
Warwick.
He knows how to pronounce his last name, unlike his cousin Diane.
Oh, right.
who doesn't have the slightest idea how to do that. But Joe Warwick actually was the journalist who helped originate the world's top 50 restaurants. And he's parlayed that into an enormous directory. I mean, it's not physically enormous, but it's an enormous amount of information about where to eat based on where chefs eat, based on literally thousands of surveys that Joe sent out to chefs around the world, and he got a lot of very famous ones to reply and recommend where they might like to go for a variety of different reasons. So it's just the thing you need if dining out is what you have in mind on Valentine's Day or any other time for that matter.
Well, I don't know how we're going to deal with this next interview. The person we're interviewing, Joe Warren, is so shy that he doesn't talk much. So what are we going to do with a guest who doesn't want to talk about his book, which is called Where Chefs Eat? And boy, is it loaded with information. Welcome, Joe.
Hello. How are you doing?
Okay. So you're visiting us in the U.S., right?
But I'm in New York at the moment, yeah.
You're in New York, and you live in London.
I live in London.
This is a project. It's an ongoing project. You started it. How long ago?
We first started talking to the publisher, Fiden, about 2 years ago. They publish an awful lot of high-end cookbooks for people like Brandy Redzepi and Ferran Adria. And I've gone around interviewing a lot of chefs around the world. And any time I go anywhere and I've got a spare meal or two, I always ask chefs for recommendations of places to go. And they've never really let me down. And they've noticed the same thing when they went to go and see Brandy Redzepi or Ferran Adria or whoever. They'd sort of say, oh, where should we eat? And they had this list of restaurants. And I also was lucky enough to go to El Bulli a few years ago before it closed. And they used to keep a list of restaurants that they would give out to customers and friends after they'd gone on their pilgrimage to Elbilly. So those sort of things were swirling around, and when we talked, we thought, yeah, this is a great idea. Let's get a list of the places around the world that chefs eat in and would send their friends to and would send their customers to, and that's what we've done.
400 chefs?
400 chefs around the world. We've got 2,500 places in there. I won't say just restaurants, because there's everything from cafes to fast food stands to some very high-end restaurants. But yeah, it's a mammoth travel food bible.
it's interesting, Joe. I don't know if Anne remembers this or not, but we dine at a lot of the same places that were in your 50 Best Restaurant Awards list, something we should talk about in just a second, because in a way it was part of how you got to this project. But when we went to the restaurant Arzak in San Sebastian,
right,
they gave us a list, but they said we were allowed to use it, but we weren't allowed to share it with anybody else. So they wanted their favorite places to be secret. Now you got people to do the opposite.
Well, actually, the Arzak, Juan Marie and his daughter both did a survey for us. And, yeah, I think the Elbilly list originally was that kind of thing, was a secret thing. But I didn't get the feeling the chefs are holding back. I think they've been pretty honest. Maybe they have got there's a secondary list of secret places that they don't want people turning up to. But I think actually they like putting business the way of places that they like. They like endorsing it. And I think it's interesting at a time where we're moving towards restaurant guides that are crowdsourced through surveys and online. And some of them are very good, but you're always left thinking, who's recommended these places?
This is an interesting book from that point of view. You can attack it in a number of different ways. First of all, it's got an alphabetical index in the back. So,
right.
So if you hear about a restaurant, wherever in the world it happens to be, if it happens to be the city you're in or the place you're going to next, and you haven't the name of the restaurant, you can find out if it's rated. So that's one way of using it. And then when you find out if it's rated, you can find out who said what about it, which chefs liked it.
All the contributing chefs are listed in the front with their lists. Then, like you said, we've got the alphabetical list in the back, and then we've got a series of lists for breakfast, late night, bargain, expensive, all the different categories that we've got. We've got 8 different categories.
Another way I looked at it, I thought was very interesting, was I looked at it through the names of the chefs.
Right.
So I looked for chefs whose names I knew, and I looked at what places they recommended, which was another interesting way of looking at it. And then you've got the third way of looking at it, which is geographically. And the main listings are by country and by city, and then within city by section of the city. So, for example, your London entries are very large, and they're divided up somewhat regionally by where you are in the city. So it's got a variety of different ways of using it. The only problem is it's a bit like it's a small brick. So it's not exactly easy to carry around.
It's a brick. It won't fit in your pocket, but we're doing an app as well that's coming out later this month. And we're just waiting for approval from Apple. I mean, the idea, ideally, I'd like you to sit in your sumptuous library flicking through this lovely brick and then take the app with you so you've got it on your smartphone so you can search through things more easily. But I think it's a nice thing to flick through for those reasons you said. You can have a lot of fun going back and forth and going, what's he setting and where's that place?
Right.
It's really fascinating to sort of backtrack. We were recently in Bristol just before Christmas, and we had just heard about a restaurant called Casa Mia. Which is the only Michelin star anywhere in Bristol and generally in the West Country, except for, I guess, for Gidley Park. And it was really interesting to find out that Chef Sat Bains from Nottingham recommended it in your book.
So there
aren't a lot of secrets left.
Oh, I was going to ask. I mean, you sound like you pretty much knew what you were doing going into this project. Were there real surprises for you? And if so, what were they?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of surprises. I think what's quite fun about it, I'm here in New York. This is a very useful book for me because people keep saying, how many of these restaurants have you been to? And I was going, well, that's not really the point. But say, roughly speaking, I've been to a fifth, I've been to 500. There's another 2,000 that I haven't been. So I'm now going to Charleston this coming weekend because I've got to do a big drive up, and I'm stopping in Charleston, which is a place I haven't been to for a few years, and I've got a whole list of places I want to go to in Charleston, so it's useful for me. There's no way I'd kill myself if I'd been to all these restaurants already. But in terms of surprises, it was the kind of wacky fast food places that are recommended. There's a herring wagon in Stockholm. There's a small road place, which I think Rennie Redzepi has made rather famous now, called Schunemann. Simons in Copenhagen. There's a place that does a thing called Wetburger. I can't remember the name off the top of my head, but this guy in the 70s in Istanbul, you know, noticed quite rightly that maybe the market for kebabs was saturated and developed this thing called a Wetburger, which is this sealed burger that's steamed in this pungent garlic and chili oil, which sounds incredibly messy, and I really want one of those.
Yeah, me too.
Best hamana burger sandwich in Barcelona, allegedly, according to Albert Adria. Those sort of things are really fun. And the little neighborhood places, the chef hangouts that they go to late at night, because I think it's not always easy to eat late at night in cities, but if anyone knows where to get something good to eat late at night, it's a chef.
Yes, exactly. So do you systematically update this? Or the one thing that's always bad about books like that or guides, even the Ultimate Insider's Guide, is that the shelf life is so short.
Well, with the app, we're going to be able to update the app, which is going to come out later this month. So that's one way of updating it. But we are looking at doing this again, depending on how well it takes off. And the response to it's been really good so far. So we'd maybe look at doing this every couple of years or every year. It depends. I'd love to do it again, and I'd love to make it even bigger. More chefs. Get more restaurants in there. I think if I had my way, you'd probably need a crane to lift the book at the end. But publisher's not so keen. You got to stop somewhere.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. Listeners ought to pay perhaps a little bit more attention than they otherwise might, because before we came on the air, we talked about what you had done before you embarked on this venture. And you said, by the way, I happen to be the one who invented the 50 Best Restaurants Awards.
Well, I didn't, to be more accurate, I didn't invent it. The restaurant magazine, when it started in 2001, had this strange situation where there were three editors. Well, I wasn't the editor, I was the staff writer. All three, over the years, have claimed ownership of the idea. But as I recall it, I think we were in the pub, we were thinking of a way to get publicity for a newly launched magazine, and someone said, why don't we do the best restaurants in the UK? And someone else, and we still don't know who, said, no, why don't we do the world? And that was it. That was how these ideas are born sometimes. I was the guy that had to work on it from the beginning. And I remember right at the very beginning of it that there was a flaw in it. We never said best for what. But that was one of the reasons that it didn't, that for me, it's maybe flawed. It's grown into, the assumption now is that it's this list of gastronomic temples. But actually, when we started doing it, the idea was to produce something more like this, not on this scale, but more on the scale of the idea of where chefs eat, and get lots of different kind of places there.
You have Noma, who can't get a third Michelin star, but fact that it's the third year in a row it tops the list, despite the fact that it has how many seats, and it's a book for the next dozen years. And one of the rules is totally a lie, is you can't vote for the restaurant you haven't been in the previous year. I mean, it's totally impossible.
It's 18, I think it was 18 months was the rule I brought in. I think that's still the rule.
You can't get into that restaurant.
Well, I mean, I think actually the kind of people that vote in that list probably can get into that restaurant. I'd say that would explain that. But in terms of, it's a barometer of culinary fashion. That's what it is. It moves a lot quicker than Michelin. Michelin take their time. But I think also, I'm not saying this is the reason Michelin started rolling out their guides in Asia and across North America, but when that list first came out, Michelin only did guides in Europe. So, and I think they looked at that and thought, oh, hang on, what's going on here? So it's made people, I think, and it coincided with the growth in the internet, all of those things. And I think people now do plan their holidays around where they're going to eat. I think people always did, but I think it's a lot more common now for people to plan a holiday around a restaurant.
Too. And I think that one of the unique things about this book that you just produced is that it takes you to places that you may not automatically think about in Asia, for example, Australia, New Zealand.
Iceland.
Iceland, yes, I thought that was pretty interesting.
Newfoundland and Canada as well. I've had people know about Montreal and Toronto, but Newfoundland, there's some fantastic places up there. So it is. It's nice to kind of shine a light on those lesser celebrated parts of the world for the food. I mean, places like New Zealand that people forget about because they're down there.
Most of
everyone
their
talks about.
Go to London. Their chefs go to London.
Yeah.
Or New York.
But they've got some fantastic places there as well that are worth going to. So, and I think people want to shout about it. They want to shout about what they've got. And some places have better restaurant scenes than others, but everywhere's got somewhere that's worth going to.
That's one message everybody must really take away from this book.
Well, I tell you, listen, I think this
Peter
is a
loves
good,
this
I think
book.
This is a good book. I looked at this book.
He was having more fun.
More than ended. I really had a lot of fun. figuring out who liked what kinds of places, and sometimes I was right and sometimes I was wrong. But the people who are featured in here are people whose opinions about food count because they themselves are masters of the business. So they're not going to like somewhere that isn't any good for some reason, and it's interesting to explore what it is. And the London coverage is extremely strong. The Australia coverage is excellent. The Italy coverage is excellent.
You know,
the Spain coverage is excellent.
I think we should note that it absolutely does not look like one of Fiden's great restaurant books.
It doesn't, but it does the job, and the app is going to be absolutely tremendous.
Yeah.
So
it's not a piece of food porn. There are no pictures in it. I think it looks, it's striking. It's a nice looking book, but it's a directory is what it is.
Oh, I think it looks exactly like it should.
Fiden do beautiful books, but the battle, well, not the battle, but what I wanted to do was do something that was really useful. That was just an important thing to me.
Well, how much say did you have in the design of this?
Well, not in the design of it, but in many ways, I didn't get the art director, picked out the cover, and they've got this unusual thing which I haven't seen before on the book is ink blocking on the side.
Now, I thought that was hysterical. I thought, because we've had books like this before, but what it says is not for resale.
I think the content, in a way, informed the design. We couldn't, right from the beginning, say, look, we're not going to do pictures, because the problem is, something like this, if you start putting pictures in it, and maybe you only put pictures for the ones that you give the longer reviews to, but unless you've got a huge budget and you can go and photograph all of those restaurants, you're getting call-in photography, and the standard of the photography goes up and down. So, this is about the restaurant, about telling people to go to these restaurants. And also, they're not all written up, so there's websites there and directions there, so they can kind of do their own research as well. It's a list of recommendations, and to do 2,500 places, that was the way we had.
I wanted to mention something earlier on, but I couldn't get my word in edgeways. The interest.
What are you trying to say?
This printing is in fact typical of what they do with directories. So old-fashioned directories, and this is a new-fashioned directory, did indeed have this block printing of advertising and that kind of thing on the edges of the pages, and I'm sure that's where Fiden got the idea from.
Yeah, I'm sure that's where the art director got the idea from, you sort of saw it, but I hadn't seen it in a book before, so I was kind of, I was initially, ooh, what's that? I'm not sure, but I've grown to love it. And I think it's a book that it sticks out.
Yeah. Well, you also want to give the website, don't you?
I do, so wherechefseat.com. It's a website, so there's a lot more info about the book there. Some films as well that we've done with some of the chefs that contributed. In this social media age, we're also on Twitter, at Where Chefs Eat.
And the app will be called Where Chefs Eat?
And the app will be called Where Chefs Eat, which is ready, but all apps have got to go through Apple for approval. So hopefully, I've been told the latest, it's going to be out by the end of this month.
Great. Well, thank you so much for what to me is a great contribution to helping people who don't know where to go to figure out where to go around the world to Where Chefs Eat, or just for a new idea about where you should eat, if this is kind of opinion that you're interested in, and I think you should be. And don't go away, because we'll be back with more for Valentine's Day right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, are you smitten this year for Valentine's Day? Deb Perlman certainly is, which is why she started her blog website, enormously popular, a few years back, and it's called Smitten Kitchen. And so that is, of course, the title of her newest book. She just wrote a book called Smitten Kitchen that guarantees that if you're staying home to cook for your loved one, you will have good, delicious, and accurate and easy to produce recipes.
And you may be sure that that's exactly what Peter's going to do for Anne, because he's too cheap to take her out. Anyway, here's Deb Perlman, who'll save you for Valentine's Day if you decide to do it at home.
The home cooking public is smitten with Smitten Kitchen, and Deb Perlman, welcome on the menu, Deb.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, now you produced, how old was the blog? How long did you run the blog?
So I started the blog in the fall of 2006, and so it's six and a half years old now.
Okay, and you've come out now with this, your first book.
Mm-hmm, it
came out in October, in the very end of October, and it is the first and only.
The first and only so far. I wouldn't bet on it. Everybody comes up with another book. You probably already know all the things you had to leave out of this first book that you're collecting.
I've got this site to sort of pick up everything that I might have put in a book that I didn't, so it's sort of like, I don't know, we'll see. I'm still, it was a very busy fall. I did a lot of book touring. I'm about to do some more, and so I haven't even thought beyond the book that's done.
Well, you have done a lot of things. The list of things that you've done is sort of amazing. A record store shift supervisor. You used to write happy birthdays on bakery cakes. Art therapy. A technology reporter, which, by the way, I did once, too.
Oh, yeah. Well, I hope you were better at it than I was.
Well, I mean, it was funny. I did it for USA Today. And I thought, oh, I felt really out of it because I didn't know anything about, you know, I used to submit my copy on a manual typewriter where the shift cap thing was broken, you know. But one article I did, the editor said to me, what's a server? And I figured, uh-oh, I'm not so off.
Let me go Google that, is what I would say.
But what, was there a aha moment that told you you were going to be in food?
You know, there really wasn't, but when I started the site, I was not the first food blogger in any way. There were a whole bunch out there, and I read them all, and I felt like they all had angles. They all either cooked for a living or liked, they had a very specific hook, like Chinese home cooking or Texas food, or maybe they were amateurs and, you know, journaling their progress in the kitchen, and I didn't really have an angle or hook, and I'm not a trained chef, and I've never been to cooking school, so I expected the site to last 6 months, and I'm still surprised that it did not, I guess. So for me, it was very gradual that it grew.
Well, you have millions of followers.
Just like a little bit each year, until it got where it is now.
But, I mean, you have millions of followers on your readers on your website, right?
Yeah, the site has quite a few. There were something like 9 million page views in January, which is, the thing is, I can't get my head around it. Like, can you imagine what 9 million is? I can't. Like, it's just crazy. Yeah. So it's amazing, and I know it's a big number, but it's very hard to understand what it means.
You know, I keep trying to figure out who listens to our program.
Yeah, and what it would look like if they were all in a room. Like, would they be nice? Would they be? And that, the book tour was kind of this surreal experience because I actually got to see a room full of some of these people, and they were all
let me give you
and well-dressed, and they had great hair, and I was like, who are you talking to me? Don't you know I'm a dork? Like,
let me give you a clue. Here's a clue to give you an idea of what 9 million is. 9 million is just a little bit more than the number of people in London.
Oh my goodness!
And a little bit more than the number of people in New York City.
Oh my, you're right. We just don't think of numbers that way, but you're right. New York City is 8 million people.
So that gives you a clue. That's a lot.
Yeah, but it's going to be spread out over the globe. I mean, we were surprised to find Russian listeners to our show because it's all in English, you know. Oh well. But enough about that. Let's get back to this book. You ended up with a shtick, though, right? I mean, you address the audience for home cooks who want to make something that's perfect, and you obsessively pursue the perfect recipes, right?
Yeah, I sort of hope that even if it's not perfect, that it's sort of, because if you ask for perfection, it's just, well, nothing's perfect. But I think of the idea like, you know, maybe you don't feel like making the same chicken you already know how to make, or maybe you didn't know about this cool thing you could do with potatoes. That's sort of like where I get excited about, like, here's this thing I add to my grilled cheese sandwiches that to me just makes it transcend everything I ever knew about grilled cheese sandwiches. So those are the things that get me really excited to try something new and to share it on the site or in the book.
Well, you do say that you're obsessive. You probably are.
A little.
Yeah,
but that's more about that I have something really specific I want to make, and I know what I want it to taste like, and if it's not that, I just don't want to waste my time with it. Like, I don't want to make average chicken soup. I don't want to, you know, like, I guess I'm kind of a picky eater. This is the thing. Like, a lot of kids are picky eaters, and you think they grow out of it, but I'm not sure I entirely grew out of it. But the pickiness, I think, is a big part of, like, oh, but I always find this dish boring, and so then I challenge myself to make it in a way that I don't find boring. And that's where a lot of these recipes
come from. Yeah, you're really unafraid. I mean, I read your recipe for skinless, boneless chicken breast, which you refer to as cardboard.
Press sawdust. Not a fan.
I was like Mario Batali when we interviewed him, and he actually says it in one of his cookbooks. He said he's glad now that they you can actually buy parts like legs and thighs,
mm-hmm.
so that you can throw the chicken breast at the dogs.
The chicken breast with skin and bone can be very delicious, and there are a lot of ways to cook it, so it has a lot of flavor. And I know because I'm obsessively looking for them, because the boneless, skinless chicken cutlet, the way most of us know it, I find to be rather blah. And so I've challenged myself. Sometimes I brine it with buttermilk, and sometimes I will, you know, soak it in a sauce, and other times I'll just bread it and fry it or pound it thin. And so there's a lot of ways to play with it, but in general, as it comes out of the package, it's not my favorite thing to eat.
Well, of course, it depends on where you got the chicken and where it was
that
grown
too.
And how it was fed. And, you know,
in most cases, smaller pieces, smaller birds have more flavor.
Now, I noticed one recipe in the book you were actually attributed the recipe, which is a lamb chop with a nut and spice recipe, to Floyd Cardoz at Tabla.
Has
he been on your show?
Yes.
He has several times,
Did he talk about the Giants?
No.
I don't think he did.
But I know he's talking about obsession. Yes.
So his restaurant, Tabla, was one of my first favorite restaurants in New York.
Yes.
Okay, my first favorite restaurant was probably this fondue place I went to when I was 8, so maybe it doesn't count. I loved his restaurant, and I know it sounds like, because I do a lot of, like, really middle-of-the-road home cooking, but I loved his use of Indian spices with American foods, and I found it very inspirational. I was very sad when it closed, but he's also cooking at a really great restaurant downtown now that I go to as much as possible. But it was just the simplest thing. They had this popcorn at the bar that was covered with this Indian spice mix, and I was obsessed with it. Like, I would eat it by the bowlful. I'd be like, more popcorn, bartender. I asked him, I emailed him, he emailed me back. I was like, can I have the recipe? He's like, no. So I asked a waiter, they were like, no. And so I did everything I could, and then one day I tried this spice mix. I had a lead. I found it on, like, a chow hound board, and I went to the store and I bought it, and I was like, this is it. I mean, it's not exactly. They did their own blend with it, but it got really close, and I love it so much.
There's a recipe you ought to get from Floyd if you'd still communicate with him. He actually cooked it when he was at a fundraising event in Pittsburgh, and we interviewed him about it, and it's a Goan recipe where they cook shrimp, and they cook it in a spicy sauce because they're going to keep it for the next 3 to 4 months.
Wow.
Because during the monsoon season, they can't fish for shrimp. But they need to have shrimp that will last through that period of time without refrigeration. And it's a fabulous recipe. It's the kind of recipe that should go out on your blog.
That sounds awesome. I'm going to dig it up. I'm going to find it. I have the cookbook that came from Tabla, and I also know that I've just read interviews where he said that his watermelon black pepper shrimp is one of his favorites. And there was another one my husband always ordered when we were there. The man knows his shrimp.
Yes,
he can do
he
good
does.
Things with it. It was like almost blackened and charred with spice. It's just, it's the opposite. I know opposite of bland sounds really trite, but he just cooks really exciting food.
Oh, I think he's exciting, too. Now, back to your book here, which we're supposed to be talking about. most of these recipes are new, except for some that you pulled from the site that were favorites, right?
Yeah, I was trying to be very careful. I wanted the book to be about for people who've been reading the site for a long time. I did not want it to be mostly from the site or even significantly from the site, so I kind of just set a number, which was 15%, and I decided that no more than 15 recipes were going to come from the site. At the same time, there were things on the site that I just felt like were the best in category for me still. I didn't want to make another apple cake, because to me, my mom's apple cake that I've shared on the site is the only one anyone ever needs, so that made it in the book. It was things like that.
Now, one of the things that distinguishes this book is the photography, which you did yourself, and it's mouth-watering stuff. I mean, it's gorgeous.
Thank you.
And then the other, you seem to devote, you have the usual day parts, but you seem to have a much richer breakfast section. You must love breakfast.
I love breakfast, but it was funny because a friend of mine who's son goes to the same preschool as mine. She's like, can I come over for breakfast? I read your book and it looks like you're making much more exciting stuff than
exactly.
us. And I'm like, oh, no, that's not Monday morning breakfast. We do a lot of breakfast for lunch, breakfast for dinner, and I definitely play around a lot more in the breakfast category on the weekend. But it's more about my love affair with eggs, and I love crepes. And so I love playing around with things like that and just coming up with new ways to make them. And so it's breakfast is a great muse for me, but I don't think that a lot of those foods need to be limited to breakfast.
And you have a way with salads. What's your favorite salad, winter salad?
So I love lettuce. If you can get great fresh lettuce from your farmer's market or you grow it in your backyard, like, it's great. But I live in the Northeast, and, you know, most of the year there's very little lettuce growing. And so you're getting it from bags and boxes, and it's okay. It's not great, but for me, I'm not hopelessly in love with most of the packaged ones, and so I enjoy finding other things to make salad with. I love the broccoli slaw in the book.
Oh, I love that, too. I thought that was wonderful.
Oh, I eat that by the bowlful. Like, it's amazing.
Okay, what's in that?
How much I can put away.
Yeah, what's in that? I read it, but tell our listeners.
So what I do is I thinly slice the stalks, and then I break up the florets, and it's raw. I don't steam it. I don't cook it for a minute. And then I have a buttermilk ranch kind of dressing. It has a little bit of mayo and a bit of buttermilk, some red onion or shallots, cider vinegar, and you mix it all together, and there's some chopped dried cranberries, well-toasted walnuts, and a few more bits of chopped red onion. And when it all meddles together, I think I got everything in there. No cheese. It's just, I love it. It sounds very strange, but most people who I've told me have made it, it has this slightly addictive quality. I think it's the sweet crunchiness of it.
Well, now, I laughed reading your whole section on kale. I mean, because I have the same reaction to kale.
I was like, can we just stop? I think I said I spent most of the last few years thinking the world would be a better place if we could stop pretending kale tastes good.
I agree.
But I have, but see, that was the perfect example, because I am picky, and I wasn't terribly into kale, but I needed to challenge myself, and what I learned is that there's really two types of kale. There's the really tough stuff that takes forever to cook. It makes great chips. And then there's this thinner, I think it's called dinosaur kale, or is it the black kale, but it has a thinner leaf, and you can really use it raw. I mean, you can use both raw, but it's really lovely. It's closer to a salad leaf. And I enjoyed making it with, it's kind of an old crutch of mine to use a honey, like real honey, real Dijon dressing, and a little bit of dried fruit, and again, a toasted nut. But I did that with pecans and dried cherries, thinking kind of Thanksgiving-y flavors, and we ended up loving it. And it has some cheese in there, too.
It's sometimes called licata kale, I think.
That's it. I always pronounce it wrong. I was afraid to say it.
And then
it's also called Tuscan kale. And then in Italian, is it Cavallo?
Cavallo Nero, right?
It sounds like a black horse. But
I basically wanted somebody else to pronounce it because I have this fear of pronouncing it wrong. But I knew that's what I meant.
The English have no fear of pronouncing anything wrong.
I botch a lot, because I type and I write words. I don't actually say them out loud, so I embarrass myself a lot when I say them.
You have a huge selection of different breads and bread-like things here. And I must say that when I read this, I thought, ooh, yuck, chocolate chip brioche pretzels. Talk to us about those.
OK, Okay, so they're not pretzels. I love making soft pretzels, but they're not actually soft pretzels in the traditional sense. Brioche is this very rich, buttery, you know, egg and enriched sweet dough, and it's often just made into little buns, and it's delicious, or into loaves, and it's just, you know, it's butter and eggs, and butter and eggs and flour and a little bit of sugar, and so it's wonderful, and it's a yeasted thing. And I just started playing around with just taking the bread and making it into ropes to make it look like soft pretzels.
Uh-huh.
And my husband, who's answer to just about everything is that it either needs bacon or chocolate or beef, suggested, fortunately not beef, but he suggested I put some chocolate in it, and so I added some chocolate chunks, and as it turns out, a delicious, yeasted, buttery, enriched breakfast bun with chocolate chunks in it is not bad at all.
Well, it ended up, after you baked it, looking much better than it sounded when I read the recipe, the title of the recipe, though. But anyhow, so there's a little bit of everything for everybody in this book, and you even have party snacks and drinks, and it's a good lesson in how you can actually produce food of quality and quantity out of one of those terrible tiny little Manhattan kitchens, which I'm very familiar with, by the way.
I mean, but didn't most people have small kitchens at one point? Aren't these big, fancy kitchens kind of a newer thing? I don't know.
Well, I guess. I don't know. I mean, we don't have a, whatever, what do you call those things?
We have an extremely inefficient kitchen.
But it's produced a lot of food.
Yeah, I mean, it's not small, but it's very inefficient.
Yeah, an island. We do not have an island.
Okay, no, we don't have an island. We do have the Purple Table, which has been with us for 36 years now.
But that's for real cooking. I mean, most people who really cook, I'm not saying you can't have a cook well in a great kitchen, but most people have workaday kitchens. They're not going to be in a design magazine, and they may not have the freshest paint on the wall, but it's yours, and you make it work because there was something you wanted to make, and you wanted to make it in there.
Yeah, I think that people who have, a lot of people that I know have really fancy kitchens, the kitchens are really designed for caterers anyhow.
I know, like, you know, when I get a caterer, then I can stop all this pesky cooking.
Well, Deb, you're a delight to talk to as well.
Thank you.
And I think that the book ought to do really well. It's beautiful to look at. It's personal. You have a huge range of recipes, and meeting almost every particular thing you might want to pick up, what part of the day, what meal. So, I mean, I just think it's a great addition to everybody's kitchen.
Well, thank you so much.
Well,
and I hope everyone likes it, too. I hope that there's something everybody wants to make in there.
Well, they're fascinating recipes, I think, but anyhow.
And here's to the next book.
Oh, my God. I got to go. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks, Deb. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And we'll be back with a recommendation for a wonderful wining and dining destination if you have a mind to be away on Valentine's Day, coming up right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And, of course, here we are for another segment with our next guest, who is very, very enthusiastic, Karen Brooks, who happens to be enthusiastic about a city that we also love, which is Portland, Oregon. And I love the title of her book. It's The Mighty Gastropolis. What a wonderful name.
And a great place for you to go. If you've never been to this wonderful city, great wining and dining experiences, beautiful scenery, friendly people. What else could you need if you're just saying, why don't I go to somewhere instead of staying home? So here's a whole lot about Portland, which is a place we can endorse that you really enjoy, and a great person to tell you all the secrets.
Well, I'm very envious of Karen Brooks's gorgeous red hair, but but I must say that that's not why we're going to talk to her. We're going to talk to her about this wonderful book that she produced, tackling a very with it today subject with a lot of perspective, I think reflective, intelligent perspective on that whole scene, which came out of nowhere in a sense, didn't it?
Well, thank you. Well, I really started my reporting on the mighty Gastropolis about 10 years ago,
oh, wow,
when I noticed a group of young talents who really just walked away from the conventions of the restaurant world to rethink what makes good food on their own terms.
Hold on a second, Karen. Did we say where the mighty Gastropolis is?
No, and I'm not sure. Did you say the name of the book? I kind of threw in the name.
No, yeah. Let's make sure people understand what
we're
it is.
We're talking about
what it is. Do you want to start again?
No,
okay.
This will be a lot of fun just the way it is.
Okay.
So the mighty Gastropolis is?
Portland.
Oh, okay. I thought Karen was going to say that.
Portland, Oregon.
Portland, Oregon is where we're thinking about.
Which is a place I love, yeah.
Fast climbing the ranks of the best dining towns in the country and probably rolling in around number 4 or 5 right now, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. And so what is interesting is how these people, so they kind of walked away from the conventional food world, and their candlelit dens and supper club looked different from anything in a white table restaurant. And soon a generation of crazy idealists join them, and over the next 5 or 6 years, in kind of a perfect storm of affordable rent, a risk-taking mentality, and world-class produce really available to everyone, they brought this wild, casual cuisine to a mass audience and really remade food culture for modern times.
Yes, but what actually moved it into center stage on the whole culinary
map?
Well,
I think people come here. It's one of the questions I try to grapple with in the book. You have food critics from all over the country. You have diners from Paris to Los Angeles. Coming to Portland, they could eat anywhere in the world. Portland does not have... We're not really in the fine dining conversation. You're not going to find a French Laundry or a La Bernardin in Portland. We don't have the money to support those dreams. But people come here, and you just go into any place, and you suddenly, you feel welcomed in. You feel part of something, a very personal experience, handcrafted food to the max. A sense of really fun eating. Portland cuisine, I'd say, is very come as you are, do it yourself, extremely local, affordable to everyone, and the weirder, the better.
Better, yes. Somewhere you
and
wrote
everyone
that.
And everyone loves that.
Yeah, somewhere you wrote, the one chef was saying that they pushed the envelope and they found they couldn't push it far enough to get people to really say it's weird. I thought that was very funny.
But it makes it fun. There's a sense of a democracy of eating in Portland. And I think Portland's not in the fine dining conversation, but it's leading a different conversation. And part of that is indifference to pedigree. The Rolodexes don't drive the mentality here. Creativity and commitment are the currency in Portland. Say, ROI means return on inventiveness.
Well, now you do have a few things going on. I guess the price of entry into opening a restaurant, if you open it in the right or perhaps we should say the wrong part of town, makes it affordable for people to get places off the ground. But you also mentioned someone who's actually been, if you like, grubstaking restaurants as well.
Yes,
so there is
exactly.
A Mr. Supporter who's interested in the crazy investment of actually investing in a restaurant.
Right, exactly. So, you know, low barriers to entry, loose regulations. So, for example, liquor licenses only cost $500 here. They're among the cheapest in the U.S.
That really
in some cities, it could be $250,000.
Oh, sure.
To get a liquor license. So in Portland, even a food cart can specialize in handmade beer.
Yes.
And so that's part of it. But also, I think that Portland kind of reminds us of just the beauty of food, which you don't need an immersion circulator or a rocket testing range. You need fire and pan. Sure, you've noticed in the book the number of places that have risen to prominence cooking on camping stoves or traveling convection burners. Right. Sort of like the beauty of folk music. Everyone has the same 6-string guitar. It's a bigger investment to launch an opera.
You're the restaurant critic and dining editor of Portland Monthly Magazine, City Magazine. And how long have you been doing that?
I have been a Portland Monthly for
2 years, and before that, I've got a really covered Portland's food scene my entire journalism career, and it's taken me through the trenches of alternative journalism, daily journalism, and now the magazine world. And during that time, I've also written, this is my 9th book.
Yeah, I was amazed.
Actually, my second on Portland. My first book on Portland was called Cuisine of the Rain, and it was about the first wave of pioneers who were creating a farm-to-table future for Portland.
This actually is where I was heading, is because there is a difference. When we first encountered food in Portland, it was all about Greg Higgins.
Right, exactly.
There
Greg Higgins of Higgins Restaurant, who actually rode a bike Portland from New York.
We've known him for years, and I never knew that until I read your
book. Oregon. And Portland, by luck and design, Portland saved its farmland. So no other American city, and even increasingly in Europe, can chefs get as close to farmlands and vineyards. And there's just staggering bounty here. And Greg Higgins peddled across the country, and he saw it. I mean, what he saw was it was here, but it wasn't organized in any way for a restaurant community. And he recruited a couple other like-minded chefs, some who had come from New York and San Francisco, brought a certain kind of a professionalism and a polish that Portland lacked. And they created this farm-to-table scene, kind of picking up what Alice Waters was doing in Berkeley. And this generation that I write about in the mighty Gastropolis is the generation that followed. Many of them trained at places like Higgins or Paley's Place, but then walked away from that trajectory where you're going to have your white chef's coat, and you're going to make beautiful farm-to-table food. They wanted to create something that was much more personal, kind of a little funkier in a way. It's just like, I can get a little storefront. I can build my own furniture. So at least several chefs have chopped down trees in their parents' yard, built their furniture, maybe have hand-me-down silverware, but they're keeping the startup cost very low, and they're investing in ingredients and trying to keep the money in the local economy.
Now, some of them are quite mad. Some of them, like Gabe Rucker from Le Pigeon, I guess you would say he's semi-certifiable, and then there are characters in between who are at least 50% mad.
Well, we love Gabe, by the way. There's even a picture of me and Gabe and on our website.
After some heavy drinking on both of your parts, my dad.
He is wonderful, and I found it very exciting that he won the James Beard Award for Rising Chef last year, because typically in that kind of a national beard competition, the rising chefs usually come out of the big superstar chef kitchen. It's going to be who's the rising talent in a Thomas Keller restaurant. That's the rising star. Here is Gabriel Rucker working in a little personalized den on gritty East Burnside with no backers, no superstar credentials, winning in that category. And I think it shows kind of the level of talent and what can happen when people can just get a space and when they're encouraged to do crazy things. I'm sure you saw in the book the story I tell about Gabriel and his sous chef and owner going downstairs to their basement like hitmen out of Goodfellas to power drill lamb heads for their lamb shepherd's pie, which was such a hit with diners. Diners were asking for second. He was like, that's pretty interesting. Like, where do we go from here?
Well, how many people send out the actual claws of the pigeon?
Well, I love what he does. He's so playful, and he named his place Le Pigeon. Pigeon is his favorite food. Let me just detour for a minute and emphasize it is called Le Pigeon, not Le Pigeon.
Right.
People always, it's like, lose the French accent. It's just like the park bird. But he's so playful. Often his best dishes do feature pigeon, and they often have a claw, like as a garnish, reaching out to greet you like a voodoo charm.
It's rather a startling presentation.
It is definitely startling.
Tell me this, Ken. Just briefly explain to us the organization of this book into groups. And what are these groups? One's called Beastie Boys, and the other one's called Local Heroes, Supper Club Renegades. Tell us about that.
Thank you for asking. One thing that I think ties together Portland's movement is a certain obsession obsessive mindset, perseverance, and this extreme local mindset. But that's it. People here have different preoccupations. So in trying to write about this food revolution, I thought I would divide it up into chapters that captured the different facets. And in each chapter, I would write 3 to 5 profiles of people who embodied that particular aspect. So, but Portland is, you could say our nickname could be Porklandia. We are the home of the meat layers. So one of the chapters is called the Beastie Boys. That's where you'll find Gabriel Rucker, for example. Then another chapter, Local Heroes, I wanted to look at the post-farm-to-table group, the people who have reset the idea of the homegrown table with sort of a strange beauty and extreme pleasures. One of the chefs in that group is Matt Leitner, who was cooking food that avant-garde food that looked like it was made by NASA in a local neighborhood in New York, stole him away over a year ago,
which
and he promptly won 2 Michelin stars.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you about that after you finish outlining the
chapters. So he's in the Local Heroes. And then one is called the Asian Street Food Gang, because we have some interesting people here sort of like rethinking hawker cuisine for a new generation. We have the Supper Club Renegades. The whole idea of the supper clubs, the illegal kind of underground restaurant, often roving, hopping around to different locations. As a diner, you go, you don't know what will be on the menu. It's just a fun experience. That idea, Portland was one of the sort of the leaders and the founders of a movement that caught on around the country. And then I have the Food Cart Rebels, which Portland also has one of the most original, unusual food carts scenes in the country. Many say it is the food cart capital of the country. And then finally, I did a chapter called A New Pioneer, looking at entrepreneurs who were sort of blazing some new trails on entrepreneurial models, which is something I think Portland excels at, these iconoclastic ways of setting up food business.
Now, there's another aspect of this book that's really interesting, because this is not just a guide to where you dine in Portland.
I really wanted it to capture, it's sort of like 15 magazine stories is the way I thought about it. I take each chef really plumbing into their story and their philosophy. There's a lot of quirky humor, also some offbeat culinary wisdom, and then also recipes. I mean, this book is the first kind of pivotal collection of recipes out of this region.
Right, that's what I was referring to. So it's not just if you're going to Portland, you should have this book. You should have this book because it's got some fascinating ways of combining some interesting ingredients and putting something different on your own table at supper time.
You know, here's what I hoped in part that people would get out of this book, is that their stories, in it, that you don't have to be a foodie to be interested in this book. As you notice, food weaves in and out of it. But I was trying to tell a larger story and more universal themes. And where can a do-it-yourself mentality take you? Where can an obsessive mindset take you? And then there's a lot of struggle in the book. I'm sure you saw that. People, whether it's in a food cart or a guy named Andy Ricker, who literally built a chicken shack in his front yard in front of a dilapidated house, and against all of the odds, is now considered the leading Thai cook in America.
Then he's the example of one of the things I wanted to discuss with you, is what happens when people like Matt Leitner and Andy Ricker are drawn to big lights, big cities. I mean, is this going to erode any of the impact of Portland?
I think it's a good thing. I think that 2 chefs from Portland, Andy Ricker and Matt Leitner, went to New York, and this year they were on every top 10 list. Again, Bon Appetit, New York Times, Food and Wine. I think what that says to the world is, hey, you know, Portland's not just this quirky place. There are very major talent and great thinking coming out of Portland. Andy Ricker,
he is now changing the conversation about Thai food.
Manhattan. I mean, not Manhattan, in New York.
In New York. And, of course, he still has Pak Pak in his other places here. He's sort of living both lives. Matt Leitner has moved to New York. Another person coming out of Portland, Dwayne Sorensen at Stumptown. Dwayne helped usher in the idea of sort of coffee with a point of view in these rock and roll dripperies, as I call them. The baristas talk to you like a sommelier. And he ushered in, he really changed the conversation. And years ago, he was an eccentric dude in Portland roasting out of a garage, or close to a garage. So again, him going to New York and really having impact, I see that as all good for Portland.
Great. Well, certainly we should say this, Karen, before we say goodbye. We should say, Karen Brooks, you're good for Portland, too.
Yes, I would say so.
Thank you so much.
One hell of an ambassador. I hope that one day they give you the keys to the city. I think you deserve them.
Thank you so much. It's been just a real treat talking to you. And please look me up when you're back in Portland.
So whatever you choose, whether you choose to give your loved one chocolate, whether you choose to take her out to dinner or him out to dinner, whether you choose to cook at home or whether you go to a new destination, we hope you'll have a wonderful time, and we'll see you again same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.